questions on JavaScript? Any questions? Yes. Yes. Why? Because BG color is a property of the document. So you just have to set document.bgColor equals white or red or something. Yes? It might not, no, that wouldn't work. No, that wouldn't work. Set it with a JavaScript URL, that has to be in the HTML. So you have to have body bgColor equals ampersand curly bracket JavaScript variable close curly bracket semicolon. So to use a JavaScript entity, that's got to be on the right-hand side of an attribute in a tag. That's in the HTML. When you set it using JavaScript, you would either set it dynamically in the header by setting document.bgColor equals something, or you would actually write the body tag by saying document.writeln of a string, which you'd be constructing the page dynamically or with JavaScript, and you say document.writeln of the body tag, you know, less than sign, body, bgColor equals, close quotes, plus the name of what you want to do, plus the rest of the body tag. So there are actually three ways of doing it. The two ways which give you fixed values, which are determined by the current value of a JavaScript variable, are to either use the JavaScript entity, that's the shortest, or you like most elegant, you enclose the JavaScript instruction to write it out. So those are two ways where effectively you have a HTML page which is partially constructed using JavaScript. Alternatively, bgColor can be set dynamically according to some algorithm by saying document.bgColor equals. Because bgColor is a property of document. Otherwise, it doesn't know what it's a property of. I mean, this is So any such system, it's like in Unix. If you're sitting in the root directory of a Unix file system and you refer to a file that's three directories down, it won't work. You've got to put all the necessary directories in. So if you have something installed in /user/mail/mail1, if you refer to mail1 when you're in root, you won't see it. You have to say whatever string I said. So I think it's essentially the same as that analogy. To my surprise, that this computer is at the moment working. Given Niagara Mohawk switched off the power at 6:15, that's slightly unlikely. You will tell me if BOSS is working, will you? Okay. Yes. Well, it's not clear that we have this switched on. Such a pain. Turn the microphone down, that's what causes that. The volume up and the mic. Alright. So, we were just, we're going to quickly discuss these JavaScript objects which are not the document objects. And then we'll discuss more of the document objects. Okay, so JavaScript is not the language you'll do for doing your detailed computation of your great new physics theory, but it does have some mathematical capability which are illustrated here. It has some constants like pi and square root of 2, and various methods which are given the use of JavaScript. Something like the random method to choose a random color is more likely to be useful than the sine and cosine, which are more relevant to scientific computation. So if you go to this particular example, which is on the class page, it illustrates here the various constants. So that's sort of trivial. Here you here it uses this with math syntax which I described, but if you incorporate a bunch of JavaScript object definition, object references with a with command, then it takes that object. If we go back to our nifty analogy with Unix file systems, the with command, you can think of it like a CD command that sets you in a certain directory so that all references thereafter correspond to files in that directory. So that's one way of thinking about with. So we go now to the computation example. This allows you to calculate the area of a circle, which is uses the par command, the par method, the pi constant, and it just does pi r squared, where the radius is fed in this form here. So hopefully, yes, we just get 100 pi as the area of a circle of radius 10. And here is a whole bunch of examples of the various capabilities of JavaScript. I think this is sort of trivial. You can relatively easily look these up, and you just need to remember you have the basic mathematical capability. So now we ingeniously turn in our multimedia presentation to the printed copy, so you all get out your printed copy. So we now turn to so we're now looking at FOIL sorting, and one advantage of this particular version of the multimedia presentation is that you have light when I look at when we look at the printed version. All right. So if you don't have a printed version, go and sit next to somebody who has a printed version, because who knows when this computer is going to come up again. All right. So one of the more important special objects in JavaScript is string, And string is is pretty similar to the same object in Java, and it has the same type of properties. So it has a length. So if you have a string, which here is called new URL.length, is the number of characters in that string. Here is this particular example here is a little routine which actually I use in this web wisdom system, which when it takes a URL, it tests to see whether the beginning of the URL is an http://, and if it is, it says that's an absolute URL and just returns that string. And if it isn't, it assumes that it's a relative URL and appends the current value of the base URL and returns that. So this is a way of ensuring that you always get correct absolute URLs. And so it tests on the length to see if it's smaller than 7, then it can't possibly start with HTTP because that's at least 7 characters. If it's bigger than 7, it used the substring command, which gets the first 6 characters, starting at character position 0, so that's substring of 0, 6, and then it just tests to see whether that's either FTP or HTTP, and returns absolute address if appropriate. So that's a typical example of using a string. So turning to soil 41, actually your particular version of this version of the printout has a historical accident in it. When JavaScript first came out, they didn't get it quite right, and they defined string with a lowercase s. But then they read the Java book more carefully and realized string had to be an uppercase S, and so now it is an uppercase S. When I wrote these notes, it was a lowercase S. So ignore this stuff about capital S's. Java script is like Java. Strings are the object has a capital letter. In Java script, there is only one type of string, a fixed thing. Remember in Java, Nancy described in one of her lectures that there was string buffer, which was for variables, mutable strings, and strings which were fixed. The method substring. So notice how you use this. You say if you have an object of type string, you say actual string dot substring. So this is again just like Java, followed by the arguments of substring, which are 2 indices, and that returns the string consisting of the characters which are captured between those 2 index values. And you would have actually thought that if index 2 was less than index 1, it would have returned a null string. However, if index 2 is less than index 1, it ingeniously reverses the 2 arguments and gives the locations from index 2 to index 1 minus 1. If we now turn to the next foil, which is foil 42, this, which is in a font you'd never see on the computer anyway. It is just it's just an example of a piece of JavaScript which does something extremely mundane. It takes a 2 strings called applet pname and applet pvalue, which happen to be the list of parameter names and parameter values, where the contents are separated by commas, and it effectively extracts the things separated by commas. If we were doing Perl, this would be one call to a Perl intrinsic called split. And actually, I think split is now present in JavaScript. When I wrote this particular function, split did not exist. And we needn't go through this code in detail, except to notice that it uses the same method which is present in Java called index of. And you always have to remember what's capitalized, and so in index of, the O is capitalized. And index of searches for a particular character string, which here is a comma, and the second argument of index of is the character position where you start. So if you look at the logic of this particular function, it starts at the beginning, it finds the first occurrence of comma, and then it searches again, starting one character after that first occurrence of comma to find the next occurrence of comma. In order to stop the process, it could be done in several ways, but it uses another method called lastIndexOf. IndexOf searches for the occurrence of an object starting at the beginning. lastIndexOf searches for an occurrence of a character string starting at the end. So if you call lastIndexOf, you get the last occurrence of a comma, and so you just march up to that last occurrence and then you separate it. JavaScript have a ridiculous number of capabilities associated with dates, and it's very difficult to find anything you could ever, I mean, maybe it's because of the year 2000 catastrophe, but they made absolutely certain that everything you could conceivably want to know about dates was built into the language. And actually, internally, as they store the date as a number of seconds, after the time, after January the 1st, 1970, there is no particular problem in the year 2000. I'm not quite certain. I assume you're allowed negative numbers, and so it is allowed to have a date before 1970. So actually, internally, everything is stored as milliseconds, since January 1, 1970. And there are all sorts of methods which go back and forth and extract various parts of dates. And you can set objects of type date to particular dates and so on. Again, I cannot possibly remember all this syntax, and you just look it up, at least that's what I do. Alright, so that's the end of the discussion of those particular object types, string and date, which are generally used, math string and date, which are generally useful. Here we come to FOIL 45, which discusses something far more important, which is the structure of the navigator object. So this little picture here is meant to represent at least aspects of the navigator object. It does not certainly have anywhere, I mean, it only has a small fraction of the objects associated with the navigator. So actually the first object is the navigator. Underneath the navigator is the window. Underneath the window is the frames, and we should know what a frame is. This particular display here has one frame here, one here, one here, one here, one here, and one here. So it has one at the bottom. So it has seven frames. And we'll describe a little in some gory detail how to define frames later on. And as far as JavaScript is concerned, frames and windows are the same thing, because you can place any URL in a frame. So they're the same type of object. So if you have a method which applies to a window, it will also apply to a frame. And so that's sort of like a people. People have a class of methods and a class of properties. And if you have a child, the child has child and parents both have fingers. So person.finger is a property of a person which applies to whether that person is a parent or a child. Okay. So the there's several very important ones here. We've already effectively seen the document property. That when you want to write anything on the page, you must always write document dot something. At the same level of document are two important, and these are not the only ones, but two important properties called history, which is essentially the, which is what you get from the history button on the, the go button on the browser, which of course doesn't do anything here. Well, it only has one entry, but in general it's a set of URLs you've been to. Location, which is itself an object, which defines with a set of things hanging off it the exact properties of the page, the URL, inside this frame or inside this window. Underneath document, there are all sorts of properties. In particular, there is an array which has all the forms. There's an array which has all the assets. I've only illustrated one asset on this particular diagram. There's an array which has all the anchors, an array which has all the links, an array which has all the images, and so on. All right. So here we have FOIL 46. And this illustrates the relatively complex naming scheme. So here you have a top, this is typically, so you'll have a label which is the label of your window, which here is, we'll describe the difference between top and para later on, so you'll have something like top, which is the thing which hangs over a set of frames. Then you want to give the label for the frame, which in this case would distinguish these seven different frames. Then we have the document, which is a property of the frame. Underneath the document, we might want to access something in a form, so we'd have to tell it which form we wanted. Then we would have to tell it which part of a form can have buttons and text fields, and we can have several thereof, each of those has a name. So then we have to specify which entity within a form we wanted. And finally, we'd probably want the value, which if it was a text field would be the string. So you get these relatively complex tasks and names that you have to type out. And so this is typically the most complex type of hierarchy you'll get from the Netscape basic objects. There is some historical confusion about there's some various alternatives here. If you have frames, this thing at the top here, this bar, will be frames of zero, because it was the way it's defined. It's the first frame defined within this particular window. And it's also called N-bar, N-B-A-R. It just happens to be called that, I know. And you can refer to this as top.N-bar, top.frames of zero, or top.frames, quote, N-bar, close quote, N square bracket. There are actually three ways of referring to a particular frame. The name, the index into the frames array, and that index can either be a name or a number. In the case of forms, you're only allowed to use two methods of referring to it. You can say forms of zero if it's the first form in a document, or if the form has if you specify a name attribute to the form, you can just use the name of the form. However, you may not say forms of open square brackets, dark quotes, the name of the form. So I believe those are very unfundamental issues connected with the historical development of JavaScript. So we will illustrate on the next foil the difference between top and parent. When you do more advanced JavaScript, a very useful property which was introduced in JavaScript 1.1 is called opener. And opener is a property of a window, so it's at the top level. And it's null unless you spawn that window from another window. So one of the things you can do in JavaScript is open a window, which basically creates a whole new Netscape browser. And that, of course, has a window. If you wish to reference JavaScript variables in the original browser, you can do that. You just say top.opener dot. So actually, we're going to have yet one more level of hierarchy, because in general we would have a set of windows on our page, and we would want to reference JavaScript variables between those windows, because we might have a lot of useful functions in one window or a lot of useful variables, and we can do that by introducing one level of hierarchy. And opener, which was omitted in the original definition of JavaScript, is a particularly useful way of doing this. If you read JavaScript books, they will find a nifty way of doing it without opener, which, however, is no longer necessary. So this is sort of illustrated here. It also tells you the difference between parent and top. So if I'm living in this window here, which is the total window, in the bottom left-hand corner, which has two gray things and one red thing divided into three. Top, if I'm anywhere within those, if I have a frames here, but I mean any of those five frames, top refers to anything which is the parent, which is the parent of every, of all those five things. So I shouldn't say the word parent, the thing that originated that, so it's the original URL, and the JavaScript in the original page has defined it. Now parent, if I'm in these gray windows, parent is the same as top. The parent is the, to get the parent, you just go to the thing that defined the current frame set. So parent is one level up, top is indefinitely in any number of levels up. So if I'm in a red frame, parent represents the page that was loaded and just has these three red frames. And top refers to the top of the gray window. In the gray windows, top and parent refer to the same thing. And if I do use the window.open command, I can actually set yet another window property, sorry, an object of type window called child w. So if I say child w equals window.open, that will give me another window, which is illustrated here in orange. And if I refer to child w, I will get properties inside that orange thing. So that shows you how you can define a bunch of variables of type window, or a bunch of objects of type window, and depending on what you use, you'll get different things. So this then goes into a little more detail on the window.open function. So window.open, just as I said, opens a whole new Netscape window with a Netscape browser. And you're allowed to define essentially anything you like about the appearance of this window. And you do this with the following syntax. So you have window.open, the first argument of window.open is the URL, the next argument is a so-called name, which as far as I know is largely irrelevant, I don't know why you would, you don't need to use it, and then after the largely irrelevant name, you have another argument which is a list of features, which are all enclosed, which are effectively a string separated by commas, and these strings basically tell you what you're going to put on this window. So you can decide whether you want a toolbar, you can decide whether you want a location entry, you can tell the system whether or not this window is fixed size or resizable, you can tell it whether it has a status bar, the thing at the bottom or not. You can tell it whether you want the list of directories, which are not present on this window. You can tell me whether you want scroll bars. You can also tell it the size, the number, so you can specify width and height in pixels for this window. So you can totally define the window. And those are all properties. If you go to the options, these correspond to these little toggles here in the options menu of a typical browser. Those tell you whether you have menu bar, toolbar, location, directory buttons. So most of those things correspond to what's on an option. So you can just control that. And of course it can be overwritten once you create it by the user by going to the options button and overwriting it, but just gives you the initial values. Alright. So we now go to foil 49. So we now have a brief discussion of frames. So Nancy, when she described Java, described the various ways you could do layouts, which were the various layout managers in Java. So the Java AWT determines the structure of the how a Java applet looks with the help help of these various layout managers. And if you remember, layout managers were hierarchical. You could have one layout manager and then put in a component of that layout manager, another layout manager. And so frames effectively are equivalent to layout managers. So layout managers, you were defining the structure of a page with a set of subroutine calls, function calls. In the case of frames, you're doing exactly the same thing, except you're doing it with HTML tags. And so this is a typical example of defining frames in Netscape. So I believe, my impression is actually rather easier to lay out things with frames than it is with layout managers, but both aren't terribly hard. So let's examine this particular HTML page. So the first thing to notice about this HTML page, a page like this must have no body. So this, a page which defines frames, has no serious HTML tags. It doesn't have any titles and H tags and index, lists or anything. It just defines frames, because all the real, if you like, HTML is going to be placed in the frame. So all this HTML page describes is layout. It has one exception to that inside the no frames tag, which is presumably going to go, when this was introduced, it wasn't obvious whether frames are a good idea. I think it's relatively clear frames are a good idea, and they will be preserved. And so I expect the no frames tag, which is for browsers that don't support frames, will sort of go away, because I believe all important browsers, namely Netscape and Microsoft, support frames. And frames are extensively used on the web today, so I don't see no frames as terribly important. So let's just go through this example. So you have the header, and if we were doing JavaScript, we'd put all our JavaScript between the head and the backslash head, the slash head. And then after that slash head tag, we have a frame set. And so in this example here, it says rows 10%, 80%, 10%. So this would be, in this example here, we would have initially divide the rows in three, the banner at the top, the middle, and the little signature bar at the bottom. So that would be typically where you'd have three rows. And you can, as we'll see, you can define rows either as absolute pixels or in various other ways. The way we've used here is quite a flexible way, as a percentage. It says, define this window, divide it into three, so that you have the top row is 10%, the middle row is 80%, and the bottom row is 10%. So this is not quite how this is here, but this is the same general style. It says all the actions in the middle, the top and the bottom, are just for some various labeling purposes, and therefore should only occupy a total of 20%. So this is defined the layout. So now we better do something with these three rows. We can put in those rows either a frame tag or another frame set tag. So in this example here, we follow this top 10% is defined by the first frame tag, which says source equals top banner.html. And that does what you'd expect. That top 10% is occupied by a frame whose URL comes from the top banner.html, which has to add the relative URL is defined by the basic frame. Then for the next middle, we actually divide the middle in two. And the one I've done here has a 30% and a 70%. So it's taken this middle and chopped off the first 30%, assigned it to something, and the rest is then 70%. put an index in, so I now have a frame set, and then I divide that frame set into two frame commands, which are index and called main stop. Frame set must be ended by a slash frame set, and then we finally have the frame, which is for the bottom 10% of that top frame set command, which is gives you the source for that. So here we have two frame set commands. They define a total of four frames, and then the frames are given URLs by the frame tags. So this is pretty straightforward. All right, so this is FOIL 51, and the FOIL 51 just effectively defines formally what I said for those examples. We're not allowed a body tag. One slight curiosity is that you need a slash frame set. Well, it's not really a curiosity, it's just it's quite logical. You need a slash frame set to end a frame set, but you do not need a slash frame to end a frame. The frame is one of these tags which is self-contained. It does not need to be ended. A frame set, however, includes frames. And so you do need a backslash frame set. And I keep putting backslashes, a slash frame set to end a frame set. And here's where we see the role of top, because if I'm using JavaScript inside a page which is one of the frames, and I reference the a JavaScript variable, if I wrote variable, it would assume it was associated with the particular page that was in the frame. If I write top dot, or in this case parent dot, variable name, it will assume that variable name comes from the page that defined the frame. So you just need to know where your stuff is called. Alright, so this particular page describes a sort of a peculiar feature of JavaScript, namely, you often write JavaScript that loads stuff into pages. So you would do that by setting the location property of the page. So that can lead to a problem, because here I have this beautiful JavaScript, I do all this wonderful calculation, and then I decide on a new page, and I set the location to be the page, and that then wipes out all my JavaScript, because it overwrites the page. So when you have a page with JavaScript, and you reset that location of that page, your JavaScript is gone. All the calculations you did, all the variables have disappeared. So often you do not want that to happen. So a way of avoiding that is described here, which again illustrates the use of frames. Namely, and you will find, although you don't realize it, that many pages on the web use this dodge. You define all your nifty JavaScript to be in an HTML page, which is defined to have two frames, and one of them is essentially a dummy frame. I mean, here I've defined it to be, I've said frame set rows equals 1, star. That says, define two frames, we'll assign one pixel to one of the frames. And when I wrote this, I wasn't certain when you wrote out to use 0. You can use 0. And then star means the rest. So it says, define a bunch of frames where the first frame is 1 and the second frame is the rest. So why do we do this? That's so that we now have a nifty system where we can load pages into the second frame but preserve all the JavaScript. Because if we load into a frame, The JavaScript, which is associated with the frame set, is preserved. So this allows us to set up a system that preserves, that has permanent JavaScript attached to things. So this you will find, well, this is either used in this dummy fashion or where they're real rows. The one advantage of frames is you can almost see this in this display. As I change this foil here, the system still remembers everything because all the JavaScript variables are not associated with this frame. They're associated with the header of the frame set, which had 7 frames. So for that reason, they're all preserved. Otherwise, they would not be preserved because this foil will overwrite it. So if you wish to even have a simpler one with that, without any of these bars, but just have a bunch of foils cycling through, you have to use this dodge I described here to do that. So now we come to foil 53, which defines the formal syntax of a frame set. It appears that in frame sets you can define both a number of rows and a number of columns. So that's like a grid layout in Java, where you have just a two-dimensional grid. I have never used a two-dimensional grid because it's more natural in the HTML to define first the layout in one direction by laying it out in rows, and then define the layout in the second direction. Because it's relatively rare that you want a purely rectangular layout as an X by Y grid. But you are formally allowed to do that in the language. I've not used that. You can formally specify a list of something for rows and something for columns. And we've illustrated most of the important options in defining. So the row list and column list are just the comma-separated list of values. And those values are either absolute, where they represent pixels, they're either percentages, representing what you'd expect, percentage, or they represent star, which means the rest. Star is a reasonably flexible thing, so if I have rows equals 50, comma, 2 star, comma, star, comma, star, that says start the first frame with 50 pixels, and then we have 2 star, comma, star, comma, star. So we have 3 more frames. And so we divide the remaining space so that the first frame gets 50%, the next gets 25%, the next gets 25%. So it's basically star is a wild card, which allows you to, if you use it more than once, allows you to equalize or weight with a notation 2 star or 3 star or what have you, the relative sizes of the remaining frames. It's actually relatively hard to lay out frames properly in a way that displays well on all computers. Because the difference between a typical PC and a typical workstation in terms of the resolution of the screen is very high. And so this layout here, which is sort of designed for the SGI,